You're listening to the Creepcast on DownrightCreepy.com. Now, here's your creepy host.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Creepcast. Casey Canton here, along with Adam Roberts. I'm at Downright Creepy headquarters. Adam is at Screenland Armor, and for once, we're actually doing a video podcast, so you'll be able to check this out on YouTube, and then catch it where you always have on Apple, iTunes, Spotify, and so on. So, Adam, how are you doing? Good to see your face.
I know, there you are, there I am.
Not taped to a microphone anymore.
Oh yeah, I forgot that's what we're doing. We're taping photos of ourselves to look at. It's great. It's the holiday season in a boopity boop.
Right. Yep. We're almost through it. We're almost through 2020, coming down the stretch. Well, on today's show, we're going to talk about Brian Bertino's latest film. It's The Dark and the Wicked. It's going to be out December 15th on Blu-ray and DVD. We had a chance to check it out a little bit ahead of time. So we want to dive into that. And you probably know Brian Bertino from The Strangers. We'll get into some of his kind of film catalog and really take a deep dive into Dark and the Wicked as well. But since it is the Christmas season, Adam, I wanted to start out with maybe the new hot tech toy that's going to come out. You know, every year there's got to have toys, got to have gifts. You know, PlayStation 5 is probably this year's hot tech toy for... I hate saying hot tech toy. It sounds gross for some
hot
reason.
Hot tech toy. Hey, does that mean like everybody? Because there's a new Xbox as well, Tim. I don't care.
No one cares about that.
Yeah, I don't know if anybody cares about it, but there is a new Xbox.
We've got, you know, hot toy list every year for adults and kids. And I've found something that I feel like, you know, it's in concept mode right now. But 2021, people are going to be clamoring for this. It's the season for giving, so I figured why not talk about, you know, get ready now, save up for this, because it's an expensive gift. It is the Samsung M1 Home Assistant Companion. What a terrible name, first of all. They have to figure out a better name than that. But basically what this is, it looks like what I would describe as kind of a headless greyhound that was taken out of the Boston Scientific Laboratories. You know those Boston Scientific robots that I'm talking about? Have you seen those?
Yeah. Does this... I'm perplexed by what this is made of.
That's a good point. Well, it, like I said, it looks like a greyhound with like its head ripped off, and it looks like something too that's out of Black Mirror.
Yeah.
But apparently it's a perfect home companion for like anyone that's been lonely during the quarantine, and if you want to get killed by a robot. But it's fully autonomous. You're able to teach it new tricks. It can play catch, it can respond to your calls, but it's, like I said, it looks like a dog, so it's bizarro.
Yeah, I've been haunted the last couple of days. We could talk about it later if you like, but
I would love to talk about that. But yeah,
I have been haunted, Tim. Yeah, this thing is wild looking. I just keep looking at it. I'm like, what are you made of? It looks like you could like almost squish it. It almost has a skin like value to it while also being very robotic.
Yeah, I don't know what kind of fabric they used on it. I'll post a picture of this too in the show notes on Downright Creepy, so you see what we're talking about. But it does have kind of a skin-like fabric quality to it. It's gray, encased in gray, and then it's got black with black like legs that you would see on a plastic chair. And then it's got a black screen where it can monitor and like talk, interact with you, see things. Very something ripped out of like Boston Scientific or Black Mirror is the best way to describe it. If you can't see it, I should have pulled it up on our screen. But it's something that intrigues me though. As creepy as it is, it's got that red dot on the screen where its neck should be. Mm-hmm. That's where it can interact, like I said, through symbols. So is this, for in your opinion, is this like pure nightmare fuel, or would you be excited to open this up on Christmas and see what kind of tricks you can teach it?
Well, you plug it in to charge it? Does it have like solar panels somehow built on its creepy skin that like when you have to let it outside for a little bit. I
like
think
a dog, that would be incredible.
Yeah, I think if you're gonna make something like this, you'd make it like that. You make it so it like charges itself, and it's like, no, it's pretty cool. I don't know, like it's like, oh, you can play catch with it. I don't think I want to play catch with this thing.
I assume you throw it, and since it's got the sensors in it, it can go up and like maybe it can pinch it with its legs and like toss it back.
Yeah, I don't
or
know.
It just pushes it with its neck. I don't really know why I'm doing the.
I keep kicking my camera.
Oh, I thought it was Ghost. I don't know why I'm doing motions with my hands, but yeah, if it were to self-charge, how terrifying would that be? It would just never die.
It would never die, and then eventually it can reproduce. I think I want. I think I would want one of these. Maybe the most intriguing one is the picture that has like an exclamation mark and a question mark on it.
Yeah, what is that?
Because is it cursing in that image?
I know. I saw that too, and I was perplexed by what that even means. I want more explanation out of it. I'm sure there's probably like a microsite or something set up with more explanation, but
I don't think so. I tried to find more information, and there was not a lot.
It is in concept mode right now, so I'm guessing that it has to do with that. Like they just haven't fully launched it, which is why I said this is a 2021 Christmas present. How much would you pay for something like this?
No more than $300. Well, what does a PlayStation 5 cost?
Digital version is like $399. I think physical is $599, if I recall.
All right. Well, no more
somewhere in that range.
No more than $400.
But you could do so much more with the PlayStation 5.
Yeah,
I assume. I don't know.
Yeah. So, yeah, no more than that for me. How much would you pay?
I'm thinking like, yeah, I'm thinking like $299, but you know it's going to be like $1,000 or something insane when it first comes out, probably. I'd also like to be able to watch things on its face, like a phone almost. I'd like to be able to use it as almost an Alexa and scroll through it. I'd want to do that. Yeah, they need to give me some. They need to send these out as like an influencer kit so we can test it.
Yeah,
and do an entire Patreon podcast on it.
As long as it could, maybe it needs to have like a little more personality. Like, can it wear an outfit? Can it put a hat on?
Yeah, it's like, an Android. It needs
a little bit more personalization, because the problem with like robots and like most of the futuristic stuff is like everybody's looks the same. And I know it has loyalty to you, but it has no, like when I have a dog, my dog is specifically looking to me. Like taking a photo, like a Christmas card with this in it, just as it's very cold. It's very ununique.
We need to be able to put like dog sweaters on it or Android skin where it look. Could you imagine that thing just being flesh toned?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's got I don't know what it has on it. It's whatever it is. It's creepy in of itself, but yeah, I mean, I'm in if it's under $300, which I'm sure it'll be like $3,000. So
you could just call it into the room. You wouldn't have to wrap it. And then it would just walk in and probably scare the shit out of someone. But
yeah,
look it up. It's Samsung M1 Home Assistant Companion. We'll post a photo of it in the show notes on downrightcreepy.com. But check that out. It's incredible. Nightmare fuel for the future. I can't wait for the AI robot overlords to take over on Christmas Day next year. But should we get into what we're here to talk about? The Dark and the Wicked?
Yes.
Now, I said earlier this comes out December 15th, Blu-ray and DVD. It's from director Brian Bertino. You probably know him from such films as The Strangers, The Monster, Mockingbird. He was also a producer, so not as involved, but The Strangers Pray at Night, which makes a lot of sense. The Black Coat's Daughter. Mm-hmm. And that was just a few of the things. Of course, he's been a lot more. I think that's the stuff you know him from the most. Of course, The Strangers is going to be the one, right? Out of all of them, which I love The Strangers. One of my favorite films in the last, gosh, it's 11 years old, I think almost. I absolutely loved it. So whenever he puts something out and he's the director of it, I have pretty high hopes for it. What was your take on some of his previous work other than Strangers? Because I thought you liked The Monster a ton, right?
I did like The Monster a ton. I think it was one that, well, I don't know how many people actually still today have seen that movie.
Yeah, it was not a big release at all. It really flew under the radar.
Well, I think it was supposed to be, I think it is an A24 release, isn't it?
Oh, I didn't think it was. It might have been.
I think it was.
It would have been an early one if it was.
I think it was one of their. I think it's one of their, like, they had a DirecTV weird thing at the time. Yeah, it is A24, and it, I think they like released it specifically through like DirecTV or something. So that kind of screwed its release up, because we weren't allowed to show it theatrically because of that.
Yeah.
I know it had a level of theatrical, but it was like Christmas time or some shit, like, where it didn't make sense. But I really like that movie. I think it's his directing is very. I'm fully surprised he hasn't made a lot more films, because first of all, The Strangers is, even if you're like, I hate that movie, it's too scary, too exploitive, or whatever you want, it's so well directed.
Yeah.
And for his first film, because he wasn't even supposed to direct that, right? Like, he fell into that movie.
And we'll get into maybe a little deeper dive later, but it's, his films become very like atmospheric, almost something else as a character in the film, not just the actors. Like, the house and the surroundings of The Strangers almost became that way because they were trapped in it. And you'll see that again in The Dark and the Wicked with the farm. But we'll take a deeper dive into that later. Do you think you liked, what's your favorite Bertino film at this point, now that you've seen this? Mine is The Strangers, but I would actually put this as probably a close second for me. And I would assume Strangers is your favorite, but I don't know for sure.
I think Strangers still. I think this is about equal for me with The Monster. In that, like, you can tell that he still is pretty limited on his budget, which is unfortunate. I think I'd like to see, like, probably where this would have gone, like, had he had a full budget for this, just like I would. I think The Monster, I think both those films probably would be a little bit more. Have a little bit bigger scope to them, but I like both of them. I think The Strangers just has that budget, I think, to it. And you could really see what he can do with it in terms of, like, not only like what he can do with actors, because I do think all those movies are really well acted, but The Strangers has just a little more time and nuance, I think, because his production value is a little better. The score and the music is a little bit better.
There's some scenes in The Strangers where the music really takes over the scene and adds creep factor to it, because it's so subtle. It's quiet, and then you get the skipping record and The Strangers and that type of thing. But whenever you use characters in masks, you're going to have an iconic factor if the movie's good to begin with. Mm-hmm. And that really hung around. Like, those masks are iconic now. The bag head, the porcelain dolls, that kind of thing. We don't have that in this necessarily. So let's set up the kind of synopsis, the film, before we dive in to what we thought about it. Of course, it's written and directed by Brian Bertino, and it stars Maren Ireland, who you probably know most recently from Umbrella Academy. Michael Abbott Jr., who's in Fear the Walking Dead. He's done a ton of other things too, but kind of naming things that are more recent. And then Julie Oliver Touchstone, who plays the mother, who we see early on in the film and then reoccurring later. We should say this will be a spoiler podcast, as our podcasts typically are. This will get released before the movie's out. So you might want to hold off and come back and listen after the 15th.
They could rent the movie, right? Right now. So it's on.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's true.
Yeah,
you can put it on VOD, and then you can get it on DVD or Blu-ray. That's right. I'm glad you mentioned that. I forgot. Come back if you haven't watched it. I just want to let you know up front. So this is on a secluded farm in a rural town. I'm thinking Texas, because it's actually shot on Bertino's family farm, which I thought was an interesting caveat to this. And there's a man that's slowly dying, the father of Maren and Michael's character, and he's slowly dying on the farm. The family comes back together, kind of as one last goodbye to the dad, knowing he may die sometime soon. And then just shit gets crazy as we go on. It just starts to unravel. And that, I think, is where this film and The Strangers kind of divert in a sense. Because one is very much no motive, and it's just because you were home. We get that kind of iconic line in The Strangers, whereas this one is supernatural based and not home invader necessarily. And so I personally thought that was interesting to see his take on this topic versus home invasion, but still using in some ways the same type of formula with atmosphere and the farm and the house and the strangers being its own character and bringing something a little extra to life through atmosphere.
Yeah, I think this movie is just once more proving that he knows like how to create heavy atmosphere and a pressure cooker type situation. I think it's, you know, it has a lot of, you know, it kind of has a lot in common with the Shudder film Terrified for me, in that like the movie, this may be his least like deep characters he's written, and but like he's got the most like, I think, horror set pieces in this and horrifying moments. I think it's like probably his scariest movie, but I don't know if it's his best movie. I think just because the characters aren't as like complex as, you know, I think The Strangers work so well is because he writes all the characters and the friendships and the love stories so tight that even though we don't ever know the villains, we know we care about the characters. We don't want them to die because they just are normal people. Whereas this is falls for me a little bit more formulaic. And I think maybe that was my issue, is I didn't care too much about the characters in this. Even though they're really well acted, I think that they're just a little bit more like archetypes for like the situation. But again, all the horror stuff that's happening around them is pretty tremendous and pretty terrifying.
Yeah. It's interesting because I feel like the pacing of, and I pull back to The Strangers just because I feel like it's a decent comparison of how the stories get told, but the pacing of The Strangers is very much a slow burn. Whereas this one, we have more characters involved to begin with than The Strangers, the two people basically, and then the antagonist. This one, we have more characters, I feel like, to get to know throughout, even though some have small parts.
Yeah,
the brother, the sister, the mother, the father are the main ones. And then you get Charlie, who's like a farmhand, family friend, that's there at the beginning too. But I do feel like, in my opinion, I think this might be where we differ a little bit, is you kind of see the weight of the family start to weigh down. You see the relationship strains from the beginning between the brother and sister, because she's never around, but he's there to help out more with the farm and maybe dealing with it a little bit more than she has. And of course, Charlie, who's seen a day-to-day thing. We also have a nurse, like a hospice nurse, that's been at the family farm day after day, taking care of the sick father who's bedridden, basically in a coma. But the reason I say I feel like we get to know them more is because I think playing on the rural aspect of it, and maybe even unfortunately more so, I took a lens through the pandemic of loneliness on a farm and how hard it is to farm. You can see the weight of the family, not only just day-to-day life and trying to deal with this death, but then when we bring in a supernatural kind of demonic force that we'll talk about in a second, you see it just unravel more and more, kind of like an onion, and seeing these people's minds deteriorating, more so the mom right off the bat, because she's lived through it day by day. But then I started to tap into the lens of rural farming families and what they go through, and the suicide rate that's went up in those families and in rural areas, and maybe even more so now. And looking at that through fiction and nonfiction, and how he wove that, I felt like, into the storyline of almost that type of life. And ultimately we see it happen, but we don't see it necessarily just through, oh, it was a mental illness. It was something driving them demonically to end up dying, if you will, which we'll get into how that happened later. So it was an interesting lens. I don't know if he meant to do it that way, but that's how I interpreted the life they had to live.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's just like a little bit more mundane, and particularly the daughter is much more removed from this slow and kind of, I mean, I guess living on a farm, like life is just slower, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's a better lived life. And I think we see in this instance, I think a lot of movies show like, oh, you live out in the country, everything is great, and you don't really have to deal with the hustle and the bustle of the big city and, you know, all these things. And But in this instance, you see, like, it is like a slow decay, and like, it might not be great. And maybe, you know, the loneliness and the lack of somebody really taking care of you, especially once your kids leave, is pretty interesting, I think. And I think you're right. Like, and this movie is made pre-pandemic, but putting it in the pandemic style where a family is kind of locked in this like facility together, it is a pretty interesting lens, I think, to put it on. But also, this movie's pretty, while it's very scary, when people are dying and it's gruesome, it's very gruesome.
Yeah, it's honestly, it was very tense for me. Some of the scenes leading up to deaths, it was more scary than I would have thought it would have been, and more tense than I thought it was going to be. I mean, I had heard some rumblings about this on the festival circuit, and I was sad I didn't catch it before now. But it was really effective, I thought, in those scenes. And that is where, more so maybe the dad Michael Abbott Jr. played, I felt more sorry for him toward the end, and we'll get to why. But I connected with some of those characters, and then the mom connecting with her a little bit more. And I wanted to bring up a specific scene since you brought up they're gruesome, right? Mm-hmm. That kitchen scene.
Yeah.
Where she's chopping carrots, and it's the tension's growing with, you know, she's chopping, she gets a little chop, faster. Baby. It is a hard chop too. And I'm like, how much carrot does she have? It's just like chop, 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 chop. And then she runs out of carrot and finds that her fingers would be a nice substitute, and just chops those things. And man, it was like a rhythm, like a maddening rhythm that happened until we start to see her fingers get chopped. And she cries, she sees she's doing it, and then just continues to do it. So at that point, you know, her mind is just gone. Whatever has been bothering her that she's been monitoring on the family farm has finally taken her over. And I believe we go from that scene in the kitchen. She's by herself. Everyone's asleep, we assume, as she's chopping. And then it's a hard cut scene, if I recall, to them going to the goat pen, and she's hanging in the goat pen.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think I don't know if it's, it definitely goes from that to, there might be like a scene with them, and then they are led outside. Because is that when he sees, does he like wake up in the middle of the night and see like the mom outside?
Oh, that's after, because he's okay. Pretty skeptical. The brother's pretty skeptical. The sister ends up becoming a little more receptive once things start happening, because she's experiencing it firsthand. But up until that point, the brother is just like hearing of things, right? Like hearing hallucinations happening. Hasn't experienced them for himself. I will say, the one note, we see her hanging, right? And I'm like, mm-hmm. How did she get there? Like, they have to pull over.
I think as it happened, I thought the same thing. And I was like, well, I guess this is just meant to show you that it's impossible that she could have hung herself, because like something else had to do it.
Which I will say, I'm happy that they addressed that.
Yeah.
The characters addressed it. Everything, even as it gets supernatural in nature, is still rooted pretty well in reality of them questioning stuff. It's not just kind of passed over. I mean, it affects them, and to the point of where they're questioning, like, how could she have hung herself with no base under her, right? And not even nearby. Like, you couldn't have kicked a goat pail that was the size of, you know, 3 or 4 foot long heavy metal thing. But yeah, the kitchen scene into the scene where she hangs herself is really where things start to ramp up, and it doesn't take a ton of time.
I was gonna say, that's like there. Maybe 15 or 20 minutes into the movie.
Mm-hmm. And even the opening scene of her in the goat pen, the mother, there's something not right, because she's hung up all these bottles and like iron things on around the pen, so if something were to enter it, she'd hear it, almost like zombies. And the wind plays a factor, and that's kind of what they pass it off as, but it ends up being something more supernatural and demonic in nature. But yeah, it's just heavy moments right off the bat, and then he builds on that kind of with atmosphere and the loneliness on the farm. I wanted to bring up the fact, we kind of brought up morticians on the mortuary collection, but the mother dies and they have to go identify the body, or, you know, whatever the case may be. It's a small rural town. A small town mortician has to be the worst, right? because you know everyone.
Oh yeah, yeah. I didn't think about that. Yeah, especially so on our other podcast that I do with Erica Havens, we Nightmare talked about Hour. Yeah, the Nightmare Hour. We talked this a week or two ago about Ed Gein. And the city he lived in was just a couple, like today, it's like, I think 1600 people. So yeah. Surely in like the time he was killing, like the whole area, there's maybe a couple hundred people. So it's like, everybody knows everybody. Someone goes missing, of course you're going to know because they're one of the 100 people that exist in this town.
Right. Yeah.
So yeah, you're right. Like, and the cops that find these people, you know, or, you know, the morticians or whatever, they surely know this people and have a relationship with them. It's not just like a big city, you know, you're not in New York City where I just found a body and maybe it's a little impersonal, so it doesn't affect me as much, but these small towns, surely, you know, everybody who's being arrested or killed or like every funeral, right?
Yeah. It has to be way more of a mental toll. Mm-hmm. Cause even if, you know, you might know some people not that closely, but you're like, I know of them. But there has to be people that die that you're close with, or like even a friend, like a close friend that now you're having to work on. And I don't, there's got to be a way, because there are morticians, to turn on and off kind of that feeling of sadness when you're working on someone. But if it's someone you know, that's got to be like, how do you do that? I can't imagine in my mind having to identify a body of someone, right? Let alone having to work on them and like, take their guts out and embalm them, and it's
classic
bonkers.
Yeah, you're right. No, yeah, I think it's interesting. It's not incredibly addressed in this movie, but like I think that would be, well, just like a mortician in general is fascinating, but yeah, in a small town, yeah, in particular, I think where, yeah, you're likely to know just about everybody you're working on is kind of strange. You'd be like always working on your friends and family.
And so we start to get some cues kind of after that, you know, the death of the mothers happen, which in some ways I didn't anticipate happening, at least not so soon, because it's really more of a focus on the father. That's why they're there. But we start to get cues with her chopping the fingers that something's not right. And then it just continues to go. It's spiders crawling out of the sick dad's mouth, which the daughter sees, the sister sees, and that's not right.
Yeah. Like
something happens. But at the same time, I remember, I think it was in like middle school, I learned some fact where it's like, oh, spiders, baby spiders crawl in and out of your mouth several times during your lifetime. Apparently, yeah, it's a thing. And I know that's a huge fear of yours, right? Isn't it? Or am I wrong about this?
It's even more specific, but it is
showers.
Drinking, it's getting a cup and not looking in the cup, and a spider having been in the cup. And it actually did happen to me once. So I don't ever think it happened to me until like 5 or 6 years ago. And I'd had that fear forever, like that you'd go to the cupboard, particularly like at night when you're like sleeping, you're like, I need a water or something, and you'd fill it up and there'd be a spider harboring inside that cup. That is the ultimate fear, that I drink a spider and not know it. So now I do, I always look in my cups. I also like, I'm a little neurotic about washing them out before I fill them up, you know, just wasting water as it were.
I don't know why this happened. Well, this has to be like a nesting thing or something, but every year at some point in our unfinished basement, we have flies, which is also a sign of like the devil, right?
I mean, yeah, you live in Amityville Horror for sure.
Right. And they happen all the time. There's so many of them, and it happened this year. And I was in my office a lot, and I've got, you know, light for Zoom calls and whatnot. And I don't know if it attracted it. I have no clue. Anyway, they got into my office, like two of them, enough to be annoying where they're just zooming around. They crawled into my energy drink, and I did not know it. And I took a big wig of it and got that fly in my mouth. Immediately did a spit take. And I knew immediately what it was.
Yeah,
because it was flying around and I hadn't heard it and didn't think anything of it. Took a drink, felt it in my mouth, and just like have never really done a spit take, but did it that day pretty quickly. It's fucking gross.
Yeah, no, thank you. That's right there in my that's in the wheelhouse of fuck this.
It's yeah,
disgusting.
I know. And so yeah, I spit that out. So anyway, we see that spider crawl on the dad's face, and I immediately thought of that moment, and then I immediately thought of you. And your rational fear of spiders.
My rational fear, yes.
Yeah. So yeah, I wanted to talk about, you know, as we start getting these cues, I kind of mentioned it earlier about the settings becoming a character in the film, and the ranch really, even more so than any other film Bertino's done, becomes that, because what we're dealing with is supernatural, demonic, like unknown forces that essentially are contained, we think, within this house. So, you know, much like a house is supposed to be kind of this safe haven, instead becomes a container of fear. And Marin, the character that plays the daughter's sister, even says that coming home and your home doesn't feel like home anymore. She said that during a Fantasia Q&A. And I thought that made a ton of sense, and something that I've personally felt when you're gone from somewhere for so long, and then that place doesn't necessarily feel like home anymore. I've been in Kansas City now for 16, 17 years, maybe. And I grew up only like 50 miles north in a small town, smaller town. And I'll go back there on occasion, but when you're not there for so long, and the, I guess, culturally, it feels different. It does feel like you're kind of in weird middle ground of not quite calling where you've lived home, and then you can't go back home because it doesn't feel quite right. So that kind of resonated with me when she brought that up. And I could definitely understand in a rural environment as well, I think, going back and feeling that way.
Well, I can't, Tim. I've lived in the big city this whole time. No, but I think you're right. Like being, like, I guess going back to like my, like where I grew up, my mom still lives in, but I don't go to that house very often. Or I guess my grandparents would be a better one, because I don't go, I go, went there even more as a kid, and then going there as an adult, just how weird it feels.
Yeah.
How like there's kind of like a rush of memories, but everything kind of feels a little frozen in time.
Yep, for sure. It makes you feel sad a little bit.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
And so I'll say that, like, that simple line kind of felt, it resonated with me, but I feel like with his style of filmmaking, it always does feel really authentic, no matter how crazy it gets, whether it's a monster or strangers or this demonic thing. It always feels authentic to your kind of almost like a fly on the wall, kind of looking over the shoulder of the characters in the moments. So I really like that aspect of it and what the setting brought to it, let alone the characters. But there's also a moment with these slow builds or kind of ebbs and flows where we kind of have that bright light go off and like a bullhorn moment, like the chopping of the carrots, the shower scene where she sees the father standing up with white glossy eyes when he's, you know, bedridden, can't possibly do that, pisses himself. And he's not there, but it's just kind of another jarring moment, if you will. And continues to escalate the madness of it, and the hallucinations really start with the brother and sister at that point. That's kind of the jumping off point, if you will.
Yeah, and that's when we start seeing like the brother. The first one I think that I remember is the brother seeing the mother like floating, like hovering. Yep. Like I guess similar to like her death, which she was hung. She's just like floating outside, and it's kind of like a double take he does, like, did this happen to this not? I mean, they accelerate from here pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Because then I think simultaneously the brother's seen it, the sister gets a phone call from the mom or a woman that's like challenging her for even coming to their back home, right?
Yep. Yeah. She's like, I told you not to come here. And that's a pattern that we start to see once the brother sees the floating mother. I hadn't thought about her being in that form because she was hung. So that's a good point that you brought up. I hadn't really thought about that. Maybe not, but I mean, it makes sense.
Yeah, that's what I assume, because I think there's another one we see that I'm like the way she's floating is similar to how her body was just like lifelessly hanging there. It looks very similar. Like she's like suspended, I guess, in that same animation of death.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. We start to hear a lot from the mother at that point. And it's interesting that they both kind of almost simultaneously have something happen to them, but they don't really talk about it because the brother was skeptical up to that point. And then he's like, shit, I saw mom. And he doesn't even tell her right away.
Yeah.
He actually tells her after he finds a journal that his mother has been writing to try and, you know, get these thoughts out of grief, and to have someone to listen to her, if you will, because she doesn't have anyone other than the hospice nurse, who apparently she would occasionally tell, like, I'm seeing stuff, I'm hearing things. But we have an interesting visitor pop up shortly after that, which is a priest, which almost reminded me a little bit of the Tall Man. yeah, kind of had a Tall Man vibe when he showed up.
Very creepy for sure.
Yeah. And he's, I was skeptical because they drive back home and here's a priest standing at the family ranch gate in the pouring rain. When was the last time you stood in the pouring rain waiting for someone when you just could have sat in your car? Like,
yeah,
no rational person does this.
No, right? Only creeps like this. I mean, yeah, the priest, instantly I was like, this guy is probably, if there is a villain in this movie, this is the guy. He's so suspect from that opening scene. And yeah, I didn't think Tall Man, but yeah, you're right. I think he does have those kind of vibes, or even like the Poltergeist 2, that guy, he's a priest.
Yeah.
No, door-to-door salesman guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's got that same kind of vibe, like just like creepy as fuck old guy. Yeah.
He has an interesting conversation with them at the table. Like, they let him in, 'cause why wouldn't you? He's in the pouring rain. They come in, they start talking to him, and he said a line that the wolf is not out there, he's already here. As to say, you know, he is a priest, that the devil's already in their presence. It doesn't matter if you believe or not. Like,
yeah,
he's not going to wait for you to believe. He's just going to come in. So I did like that line, that the wolf is not out there, he's already here. And you have a few of those lines that's foreshadowing or like supposed to layer into the story as we go throughout. But yeah, we start to get weird introductions to characters that are really one-offs and kind of throwaways, but they do add to the story in a sense, which I thought was interesting that we don't really see from his other films as often.
Yeah. And I think, like, well, with the priest and like this middle section of the movie, like, things start getting a little bit more psychological and less physical. Like, we're given some, yes, of those physical representations in the beginning, but now we start, when those hallucinations take over, the middle part of this movie you start kind of questioning what's actually happening here. It's not as simple as just like, this guy's a bad guy or this guy's possessed, so much as it's like everything around us, including like the goats potentially, are part of this devil's takeover. Dance. and in a way you start feeling like it's not just their farm, it may be this whole area, this whole town that's infected with this, like, you know, cursed, if you will, with this like devil-like presence.
Or it's at least anyone that's had any substantial time on the farm,
right?
Because this priest, we saw him there, we saw him with this interaction, but then he randomly calls, and to your point, the hallucinations and supernatural things start to really ramp up. But he calls at 3 a.m., which is, of course, the witching hour, demonic hour. Gets a creepy phone call. He's standing outside in the rain again, I believe, at a distance, telling them to come outside, which doesn't make sense because it is 3 a.m. The phone rings. I wouldn't pick up the phone. They didn't either. They pulled the fucking thing out of the wall. But yeah, the priest is a manifestation of an evil spirit, of demonic presence, and it continues to build with different characters, and we see that come to life. To your point, it kind of spreads throughout the town, you said. Does, in a sense, I think, because we see Charlie, the farmhand and close friend, have an experience in his trailer, which you assume is off the ranch, and now it's affecting him as well, which was a pretty creepy scene.
Yeah. I think after we get to once the mother kills herself, the movie doesn't really let up. I mean, you really only have that first 15 to 20 minutes before it just starts twisting and turning. And I believe that. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, it kind of goes back to the rural nature of it, or anyone that's experiencing sadness, like they were with the mom and the dad was dying, and the toll it takes. And I was reminded of a quote from Session 9 and Simon, who's like, I live in the weak and wounded, kind of meaning that people at their weakest mental state, evil will attack them in some way. And I feel like that's what we keep seeing time and time again. And actually Genius and I talked about this on Super Creepy Fun Time Hour about when people are and most vulnerable, you also see them turn to faith more.
Yeah.
And I was going to say in a rural area with a priest and that kind of stuff.
In this part of the movie, this is definitely where I think, well, with the suicide and then, you know, dealing with the devil, the goats and this like small town, like, you know, vibe, of course you get more religious people trying to latch on to like more meaning and give themselves like a little bit more, I guess, influence that's bigger than them. That's, you know, more than just the family and the harvest. But yeah, I could, and you're seeing them become maybe more susceptible to the devil's intentions and the devil's lies here because they believe in those things already so hard. And they're looking so hard to like latch onto something, even if it's like something that's like, that may end up like killing them. You know, like I think someone believing in the devil so thoroughly and its presence so much only empowers him to take over their lives, I guess. And in this instance, you know, this, I think this is leading us right to the second suicide, right?
Yeah. Yep.
I shot that.
Yeah.
I mean, this one's shotgun, a lot more like blunt, and we see it happen.
And I mean, at that point, especially, you see the Marin's character kind of cut up and appear in the trailer with Charlie, and he doesn't realize that she's not real, that there's something happening. He blows his head off, and then we get to the part where essentially the brother. His mental toll, he's spent, like he's done with this. The mom has died. He's there to try and look after his dying father, who at this point is not gonna make it. Let's be honest. Like that's the whole reason they're there and he's in hospice. So with all the weird shit happening, he's like, I'm checking out. Like you're on your own. I don't know what to tell you. You should get out too. And that goes back to an interesting quote. Once she's left on her own, I believe the priest said it at some point. If not, it was somebody manifesting through the demon or the devil. There's nothing worse than a soul left alone in the end. And at that point, Marin's character it truly is alone. It's her on this farm with the dad. You know, the mother's dead, the brother's left, and she is alone in the end. And she gets the phone call from the brother letting her know that, hey, he checked out. You need to leave too. And I think that's what you're getting at with the next suicide, right? Leading into that.
Yeah, because
he's on the road.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the movie's very short because like we're already in the third act right at this point. Like,
yeah,
like
when they, yeah, it's when an hour, actually it's an hour and
90 40
minutes.
Yeah, it goes quick. Yeah. I mean, so
it does go quick.
Yeah. The middle, there's a lot of like slow burn kind of hallucinations that we're kind of breezing over a little bit, but once the brother and sister separate, and you get her alone with the dad, like things continue to get weird at the farmhouse as expected. But what you don't expect is that it follows him home. It follows the brother home who's kind of been fighting this whole thing and is giving up on that, I guess, like his immediate family to go like maybe save his actual new family, you know, his kids and his wife. And then, you know, I think your comparison to Session 9 is a pretty good comparison because various, actually those movies are quite similar. Of course, in terms of like how the last act plays out and what is it? Is it, you know, religious or is it, you know, a possession or is it just mental instability? And, you know, we follow him home and we see, well, what we see, you know, whether he's like possessed or whether he's being tricked into these hallucinations, we know it's the devil's work, or at least we're supposed to be told this. And we see him getting home. And I think that's where we're at, right? That's me telling this is correct.
Yeah.
Okay. And then when he gets home, he sees, I believe his family is dead in the kitchen.
Which we also have cue kind of a tip of the hat, an homage to the Strangers with the vinyl record. Playing in these moments of uncertainty, he gets home to a record playing. It's kind of melodic. It's supposed to be a little more, it's a little somber, and rightfully so, because to your point, he goes to the kitchen table and sees what he thinks is his dead children laying in blood, that the mother has committed these murders as she lays on the floor with a knife. So your point, it's following him around.
Well, and then, you know, this scene was like, I was like, holy fuck, this movie is no joke at this point. Like, it's just like, it takes its time here. And we know, I think, where it's going to happen. You know, we're a few steps ahead of the character here, but we're unsure if it's actually going to go down that route. So, and then when it quickly does, like he quickly slits his throat to join his family because, you know, I think.
Can't take it. He's done.
He's lost everything at this point, like his actual family and his immediate family. So it's over for him. And then at that same moment, as he's dying, his family walks in, you know, happy, healthy, and his wife discovers him bleeding out, dying in the kitchen. And it's just like, you know, the devil tricked him, of course, with these hallucinations.
Let me ask you this. Did they trick you entirely? Because you said they were two steps ahead of the character in that sense, which I think we all could determine it's one of two things, right? But did you think that maybe the devil had beat him home in some way and had possessed the family to do something with their own hallucinations? Or did you truly think that it was just a trick being played on him?
I as soon as I saw them, I was like, oh no, it was just like the atmosphere. I was like, oh shit. Yeah. He just felt so he felt so beaten down and unsure of everything that when he saw that, he just like, you saw his, I think the actor played it really well. Like to where you just saw the loss in his face and it was like, oh fuck, I know it's going to happen, that this is a hallucination and he's going right into it. But it worked. I mean, it's just a powerful, sad way to end the movie.
I will say this, like I said, it was one of two things and I wasn't entirely sure what I thought at the moment, which I think makes it, kind of nice that things are so unpredictable in a sense at times with not knowing what's real and what's fake. At some point you realize everything probably is fake because it just starts to happen so often. But it was a real gut punch still when his family walks in. After he's slit his throat and he's laying there kind of in the corner, blue in the face, and it happens almost immediately. Like the timing seems to happen almost immediately. But it was still a gut punch when the family walked in, and, you know, he's endured all this stuff and he thought he was finally just going to go home and back to some normalcy and these people he loves. And then everything's gone. Like you said, he's lost everything, at that point. So it definitely, it was a sad end to that character, but all the characters seem to have these sad endings. And it's, we get a little bit of back and forth between, the brother and his, what's about to happen to him and his sister, Marin, that's still back at home dealing with the father. Cause she doesn't want to give up on her father. She gets a visitor from what we think is Charlie's niece, but again, nothing seems to be what it is. And turns out to be this creepy girl that lets her know, you know, Charlie died. And she's like, that's impossible. I just saw him here 2 days ago. I don't know why it's impossible. Someone could die in 2 days.
Or in a minute. I don't know, 5 minutes. Like I could walk out the door and get by a car.
Right.
That's impossible. He was just in this room.
He was just here a month ago. I can't believe this. So she comes in and repeats over and over again. I don't think we've even seen at this point the brother in his scene yet necessarily. About you're all alone. She repeats that over and over and over again, which is kind of perfect. It's almost the stranger's part, right? Like the kids come to the door, Jehovah's Witnesses, I think, and kind of discover.
Once happened, I'm like, ooh, just like a little nod to yourself, you know, like nod to the strangers.
And done in completely different ways, but
for sure.
to reiterate, you know, your brother's dead. And I don't think she knows that, obviously, but you're all alone because the hospice nurse is also taken over by the devil and like stabs herself, kills herself. And then we basically just have a sad ending to a sad circumstance where everyone dies essentially in this movie on this farm. And you assume with no real other family around to discover them. That's the other thing, is like, who discovers them after this? Right, like no one knows. You would assume the brother's family says, oh no, he's dead, like go check on the other family, and that's how they get found out that something's gone terribly wrong. But then you have to wonder, oh, is Marin a suspect in this to murder and accessory to murder, because no one knows demonic forces are happening.
So, yeah, well, and that's like something that's like, this kind of touches upon a little bit, but I've always been fascinated like how a movie has never really used like maybe they have a little bit, but maybe like not as straightforward as like a demon just, because it always leads to like a possession, and this maybe like the demon just kind of wins straight thoroughly, like gets them to kill each other or gets them to kill themselves. More often than not, I guess it's always suicide, I guess, right?
Yeah, in some way, you know, it's all for you, Damien.
right.
It's like an isolate, attack, die formula in a sense for demons. So, and not even isolate necessarily, but manipulate.
Yeah, I think that that's why I did really like about this movie is that it does take like some twists and turns with what it does to the family and the dynamic of just like
it's keeping you guessing.
Yeah. And you know, ends just so hopeless. Like, yeah, you know, she loses her dad. She's losing her battle. She lost her brother. She lost her mother. And it's just like, you're all alone. And then, I guess it remains to be seen if like this thing's going to leave this family or if it ends with this family, if the whatever has been possessing them is real, if it's done at this point, if it's satisfied.
The Dark and the Wicked 2, T-O-O. Yeah. Is a sequel for this. Yeah, I mean, we
back
just
get the saddle.
You just get like a slow pan out of the farm, yeah. and it's kind of over. Now, how did you feel about that ending? Because for me, I don't know any other way for it to end without it being cheesy in a sense.
I guess that's where I was like, the ending, I liked it. It peaked. Maybe it peaks like when the guy kills himself.
The brother,
and then it goes on for a little bit longer. I think maybe seeing like the neighbor or one of those door-to-door salespeople, like if they like somehow, I don't know how you'd show it so quickly, like contract the demonic force, you know, like just like a hint of it in some way, shape or form. But I don't know. And maybe that's what they tried to do and it just didn't work tonally or visually. But yeah, everything else still works really well for me. At the end, it matches the vibe of the rest of the film.
Yeah, and like I said, I don't know what you're not going to bring a priest in. You're not going to like do an exorcism at that point. You're not going to do anything other than like you said, pass it on, which we can only assume doesn't happen with the niece, Charlie's niece, because she in herself is just a hallucination from what it appears. She's not a real person necessarily, I don't think, that's been taken over and manipulated. It does seem more like a hallucination that we've seen before, but I gave it a little bit of points off for the ending, but at the same time, I did kind of enjoy that it ended open-ended like that.
Yeah.
And didn't try and wrap it up into a bow. So for me, The Dark and the Wicked, I have to compare it to The Strangers because that's his probably best success to this point, is kind of neck and neck, but just for different reasons.
Yeah. I like this a little bit less. Again, like the characters, yeah. I mean, it's not meant to be a likable film, I don't think. It is a little bit more dire. But I liked it. I didn't absolutely love it. I think it's something everyone should check out, though. I think there's a lot of interesting ideas. I think Brian Bertino continues to be a filmmaker with a great talent directing and a lot of his mind when it comes to his writing. I think it's solid entry. I'll check it out again. I think it's got enough in there that's interesting enough, and again, it's short.
I also love the artwork on this. Simplistic, but they also had the teaser poster, which is not on the cover, but of course this is the mother floating. They've got the windmill in the background of the farm. She told you not to come. When I first saw that tagline, I thought it was like a witch or something.
Yeah,
like that, not knowing anything about the movie. And I knew kind of very little going in, to be honest. And the other one is an upside down cross with the windmill and the cross. And it's nice visual. But I'm curious if we ever see Bertino get a large budget type of horror film. And I almost say that through the lens of James Wan, right? Like having a budget that's bigger, but still ends up being relatively small, like a James Wan budget film, right? Where it still makes a ton of money back. Because I almost like him better in this box. I think he gets more creative. I think the writing's better. It's not as mainstream as I feel like it would have to be with a larger studio attached, like a Universal or a Warner Brother, whatever. But yeah, I enjoy him in these confines, I think.
Yeah, I like him. I'm curious to see. I think he will get a shot somewhere bigger, but maybe he has no interest in making more mainstream stuff. Maybe his interest lies purely in this kind of art house horror. But maybe you never know. You saw Oz Perkins make the jump with, you know, Hansel and Gretel, his little twist on that. So maybe he'll get something in that vein.
Who he produced, Pertino produced the Black Coat's daughter. Yeah. So maybe it would be in that vein. It's interesting. So what's your final rating for this out of 100?
I have this at like a 75, 70. Yeah. If we're going whole number, 75%, like a good C, maybe C plus, maybe a little more like, again, aesthetically, I love it. It's just, it lacks a little bit for me in the characters.
Yeah. I liked it a little bit more. I had a few points off for the ending, but at the same time, I'm torn because I did kind of enjoy how it ended, but that's,
yeah,
I wanted a little more closure, I guess. Just not a bow. So I gave it an 88%. I actually liked a lot. I probably give The Strangers like a 95. But yeah, I might even be, I'm almost second guessing my own rating at this point, that it might be more like 85 or something like that. But comparatively speaking, Internet Movie Database gave it a 6.2 out of 10. I thought this was interesting on Rotten Tomatoes, because I feel like it splits a little more like we did. And I should preface with Rotten Tomatoes is not the end all be all. We're only measuring it as a comparison. I have a love hate relationship with Rotten Tomatoes. I don't know if you do, but
yeah, I love it. I hate it. I mean, it's generally a good placement. Yeah. It's in the ballpark usually.
Never watch a movie or don't watch a movie based on that. We're only using this for comparative reasons, but, critics gave it a 90%, audiences gave it a 67%. So I feel like it's close to the ballpark of where we landed, which I thought was interesting because I never looked those up until after I get our ratings in there. So, and ironically, we've been pretty close.
I think so. I think we're usually right there.
Yeah, which is strange because I don't anticipate that ever happening with that. So check out The Dark and the Wicked on VOD. You can probably see it maybe even in some theaters, right? I don't know if you can now.
I think it's out now. Yeah, I think
was really a festival run more than anything. But you can also get it on Blu-ray and DVD on December 15th. So check that out. All right. That's all we got for today. I think next time we might try and tackle Freaky.
Yeah.
Which is a pretty fun horror comedy, like teen movie a little bit.
Yeah.
With Vince Vaughn and Caitlin. Why am I blanking on her name?
Oh, don't look to me, because I couldn't. As I was watching the movie, I couldn't remember.
But think of Freaky Friday with Vince Vaughn and serial killers. That's all you really got to know. So I think we're going to try and tackle that next time, and we're going to talk a little bit about some holiday horror as well.
Mm-hmm.
Or 'tis the season. So hit us up on social media, hashtag Creepcast, @DownrightCreepy. If you like what you hear, please rate, subscribe, share it, all that kind of stuff. That'll help us. You can donate to our Patreon, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, all the good stuff. So, do you have anything to add? What's going on at Screenland? Do you have anything with your other podcast you want to talk about?
No, Eric and I are doing, we just did
Krampus, episode, right?
Krampus. Yeah. We have a little bit of holiday horror. We're doing our second part of Ed Gein this week. We're always doing something on there. I don't know exactly what's coming up. I know we're doing that game this week. And then on Screenland Online, you can rent films from us. So regardless of where you live in the country, if you're looking to rent and support a theater, we have a ton of films on there. A lot of genre stuff right now. A lot of terrific films. And they're all like sub $10. And it's just like, you know, just like renting from iTunes, but we get a couple bucks back from it.
Yeah. So that's the Nightmare Hour podcast and ScreenlandOnline.com. Of course, you can check out other shows on Downright Creepy on the Crickets Podcast Network. We have Super Creepy Funtime Hour with myself and Genius from Nightmare Junkhead. And we have the Black Magic Coven, who is also doing a Krampus episode that's coming up. And gosh, a couple other things before season one's officially done, 12 episodes of that. So please go check out our other podcast on Downright Creepy. And we have some other stuff coming up in 2021. It's going to be interesting. Some new shows that we're adding to the roster. I think it'll be a lot of fun. So All right. Until next time. Thanks for listening and stay tuned for our next episode on Freaky.
Listening to a Downright Creepy original on the Crickets Podcast Network.